Okay, let's begin. We're at the last leg of our OU journey this Shabbos, and this morning we have YU, the newest YU rusher. Officially the newest? No. Yeah, possibly. Suffolk newest. Possibly the newest Rosh Yeshiva of YU, Rabbi Daniel Z. Feldman. Rabbi Feldman has many talents. We used to, besides being a massively accomplished Talmid Chacham, more importantly, we used to work together in writing the YU Purim Spiel, which was the big show at YU every year, which we were zocha to collaborate on. Other than that, that's where our collaboration ends. Beyond that, Rabbi Feldman blows it out of the water. The author of numerous books, the author of numerous svarim, you know, Mayim Shein Lahem Sof. Rabbi Feldman is someone who has, really, there's no end. I was telling people in Shul and Shabbos, you can just ask Rabbi Feldman anything you want afterwards. Hope you don't mind, Rabbi Feldman. You can ask him any area you want. There's no area that's untouchable for Rabbi Feldman. But beyond that, more impeccable than all the impressive, his ability to make us laugh in YU, and his ability to, as a Talmud Chacham, are his midos. And that's reflected in his book, The Right and the Good, which was a groundbreaking book, really in the sense that it sought to convey the concept that just as the rabbis were obsessed and focused on the details in every mitzvah, how to do like exactly this with the lulav and that, the rabbis were just as obsessed, if not more, in how to be good to one another. And that was the point of the book, and a beautiful premise and a beautiful book as well. I know Roy Feldman writes in the introduction that it should not, he's making no claim to have any moral high ground when writing the book, but I'll tell you, because he won't, that he certainly is a wonderful person, and we're lucky to have Roy Feldman here this morning. And that's all right, Feldman, please share with us.
Thank you very much for that way too generous introduction. I assume because of the subject matter, you want to try to move as far away from Lashon Hara as possible. But it doesn't necessarily work that way, as we'll see. But it was a noble effort, and they appreciate it. And it's good to be here. I think we have a few minutes together to speak about topics about Lashon Hara, but specifically, I believe the title referred to the Internet. And whenever you speak about the Internet, it's obligatory to first mention that you like the Internet, and you use the Internet, and you're not against the Internet. So for me, that's certainly true. I'm a major user of the Internet. I think there's many, many wonderful things that have been and continue to be accomplished through the Internet. And I personally benefit in many ways. And while I'm here with Rabbi Einhorn, I'll just make reference to two that connect specifically to him. Unfortunately, I'm here in the middle of Shloshim from my father's Zichron Levracha, and my father was a Los Angeles native. He was born here in Los Angeles, so it's meaningful for me to come back here during this time. And Rabbi Einhorn, as I'm sure you know, is the major historian of Jewish life in Los Angeles, has done much to perpetuate the family's memory with his lecture series. Recommend especially part 3 of the 14 parts. So from that perspective, the Internet has been a strong bond between us. And also along that point, so my grandfather, who had served as a rav in Los Angeles many, many years ago, before it was really anything close to what it is today, and wrote Sfarim during his day, as Rabbi Einhorn describes in his lecture series. So the idea, I don't think he ever could have imagined, he passed away 30 years ago, I don't think he ever could have imagined that the day would come when the Sfarim that he wrote so laboriously, and he tried to imagine how they would be distributed, how far would they get, that the time would come when you could be in Bangkok and you could open up the computer and you could open up HebrewBooks.org and you could find his Sfarim available from any part of the world and you could print them out instantly and you could read them on the screen. So what has been enabled through the Internet is really unbelievable. It is really quite astonishing. And I should also add that I'm not only talking about the nice things, that the fact that the Internet is a venue for spreading Torah, a venue for staying in connection and communication with people who we want to and need to stay connected to. It's a venue for chesed. It's a venue to call attention to problems that we are able to address through community. So there are many, many nice things for which the Internet is able to play a major role, but also the things that are not so nice. Sometimes the Internet is also important in accomplishing. When we talk about the subject of Lashon Hara, so we know the Lashon Hara is a nuanced issue. And on the one hand, we begin with a premise that we shouldn't speak badly about others, But at the same time, there's an equally important component of it, that when something is necessary for protection of others or protection of the world, so then we do have to speak, we do have to say what's necessary in order to provide that warning. So from that perspective also, the internet has been useful in terms of warning others of dangerous individuals, calling attention to problems that otherwise would not be solved, doing things to address ills in society that maybe in a previous generation you wouldn't have the ability to really address, to make sure that people who needed to know would know. So from that perspective also, the internet does important work. And that topic, Lashon Hara L'Toeles, maybe we'll come back to in a second. It happens to be a topic, it's a major theme of yesterday's parsha. I don't think we had that in mind when we first picked this topic. But it does flow very much from this week's, past week's parsha, Parsha's Vayeshev. The issue of when Lashon Hara is justified, when it's appropriate, it's a highly complex one, and that's a part of the question, that if we assume that the internet can provide an important service both for the nice things and for the less nice things when necessary, so that's where the analysis really becomes complicated, because the question of when is such speech justified and when is it not justified is a highly complex question. It was a topic of a lot of debate. How do we know when you're in one category and when you're in the other category? Because clearly, this is something which could be very easily abused. Everyone could say whatever they want and say, well, I have a good purpose in mind. I'm trying to accomplish something positive. So you could really cover yourself with anything you wanted to say. So there was a major debate among the contemporaries, really, in the past 100 years, in terms of what are the rules for what we call purposeful Lashon Hara L'Toeles, when it's justified by a purpose, by a need, what are the rules? So among the suggestions, we have the Chafetz Chaim, who wrote the classic work of Yisrael Meir Kagan, who wrote the classic work on the laws of Lashon Hara. He wrote it about 150 years ago in the 1870s. And he felt there were seven rules, that there are seven principles that you have to have in place in order to know that what you're saying is justified and necessary. And others felt, no, it's not seven rules. It's simpler. It's that you have to have intent, that it should be purposeful. That's enough already. It's really one rule. And in the middle, there was a contemporary of the Chafetz Chaim, whose name was Rabbi Yechiel Michal Rabinowitz, who wrote a work called the Afike Yam. And in the Afike Yam, he says there are three rules. And how would he know the three rules? The three rules can all be derived if you paid very close attention to the laning yesterday. If you paid very close attention to the reading of the Torah yesterday morning, you could figure out, and you also have his set of tools, you could figure out three rules. Because the Torah tells us that Yosef, in the beginning of the parasha, Parashas Vayeshev, we're told that Yosef, V'yaveh Yosef es dibasam ra el avihem, that Yosef brought bad reports about his brothers to the father, to Yaakov, which is quite shocking. If we have a prohibition of speaking badly about others, so what's going on here? Why is Yosef speaking badly about his brothers? So there were those, including the Chafetz Chaim, who thought this was a failing. This was a criticism to be leveled against Yosef. And that had a lot to do with what happened to him afterwards, that he would be sold into slavery and that he would have this period of difficulty, was a result of the fact that he was engaging in speech that wasn't really appropriate. But there were others who felt that it can't be, that if you know Yosef's last name, then it's hard to believe he was engaged in Lashon Hara. Yosef's last name was Hatzadik, right? So how could it be that he was engaged in speech that was inappropriate? So Rabbi Rabinowitz, in the Sefer Afike Yam, he assumes that if Yosef was doing this, it must have been justified. It must have been that this was under the category of purposeful speech that was legitimate. So he says, working off that assumption, if you look at the verses, you could find three rules that emerge from specific languages that you find in the verses which are unusual. It says, first of all, this is the first rule, is in order for it to be justified, it has to be that this is the only way you can solve the problem. That the only way you can address whatever danger there is by going over the person's head to some authority figure, to a parent, to a teacher, to the rabbi, whoever it is. But if it were possible to speak to the person directly and solve the problem that way, if you'd be able to accomplish it, so then that would be the first step to take. So as you can see that from the verses, because the verses tell us that Yosef was considered to be a brat by his brothers. They didn't take him seriously. It says, V'hunaris b'nei bilha, that lo yachlu dabro l'shalom, they couldn't talk to him peacefully. So he wouldn't have had any impact on them. So if that's the case, all right, so then what are you going to do? He doesn't have a choice. He has to go to the father. So he says, that's rule number one, that it has to be, there's no other way to do it. Says, rule number two, he says, is an interesting language. The Torah says that he brought the reports. So it says it literally like that. He brought the reports. Fayaveh Yosef. He brought them, like he carried them. It's also a surprising language because there's so many words we have in Hebrew for speaking. Vayedaber, Vayomer. There's so many words to talk about speaking. So to use a word, he brought, it's not the usual kind of language you would use for somebody who's saying something. So the Afikayam says that the imagery the Torah is trying to convey, it's like when you lift up a package and you put it down, you lift up a book and you put it over there, you bring it over there, so presumably it's the same book when you pick it up and when you put it down. It doesn't change at all from here to there. So too, the way Yosef conveyed these reports, it wasn't that he editorialized, he didn't put any spin, he didn't exaggerate at all, it was exactly the same thing that he saw, that's what he reported. He didn't edit it in any way, he didn't expand on it, so it was so precise that it could be compared to carrying something. The same way a physical object won't change from here to there, so too the report of the events also didn't change. So says the Afikayam, that's the second condition, has to be completely accurate, without any enhancement, without any modifications, has to be the exact situation exactly as it is. And the third consideration says that you can find also from an unusual language, that here the Pasuk tells us that Yosef brought the reports, V'yaveh Yosef istibasam ra el avihem. He brought the reports to their father, which is a surprising language because he was also his father. Right, so why doesn't the Torah say Aviv? So imagine if somebody's in a fight with his brother, so he doesn't say to his brother, I'm going to tell your father on you. What's his phone number? Then he says, I'm going to tell daddy on you. If it's a common father, so you'll say, I'll tell daddy. I'm not going to tell your father. So why does the verse say that he told their father and not his father? So says the Afikayam, the intent is to emphasize that when he was talking to Yaakov, he had no ulterior motives. He wasn't thinking at all that this is also my father and I'm going to look better in his eyes by comparison. I will solidify my status as the favorite son. He wasn't thinking about that at all. He was only focused on the fact that he was their father, that he could correct the brother's behavior by talking to the brother's father. He didn't have any focus at all on the fact that it was also his father and maybe there'd be some ulterior benefit to this conversation. So says the Afikayam, that's the third consideration, that there has to be no extra benefit, no ulterior benefit, no side motive, only focused on trying to solve whatever problem you have. Those are the three conditions. We can glean them all from paying close attention to yesterday's parsha. So if you were listening closely, maybe you caught two, you didn't catch three, so I'm glad to be able to share the three with you. He says, these are the three principles that we can derive from this past Shabbos to know how to gauge whether our speech is appropriate. So in general, when we're engaged in speaking, we have a tricky line, because on the one hand, we have to avoid that which we shouldn't say. We have a pretty strict prohibition. It's quite a few prohibitions in the Torah. The truth is it's all over the Torah and the Talmud and everything since. It's a pretty major theme, something we have to be very careful to avoid. But at the same time, there are times when we have to make sure to speak up. If there's something that's really dangerous, if there's something that's a threat to others, then we have to know when to speak. So it's not really any safe side here. You have to really be very sensitive to all the principles and to everything that's involved. And that's why I think we have these movements, so Chafetz Chaim Heritage Movement, the movement, the idea that we should spend a lot of energy focused on these principles because they really go to the core of our relationship. They really go to the very essence of how we relate to each other. And this isn't an area where you can just say, okay, whatever happens, I'll take it as it comes. It's all too complicated for that, and human relationships are all too intertwined and too complex that we have to really have a sensitivity and awareness that comes from a lot of thought and careful analysis of these concepts. So that was true all along. That was true forever. But now we have the internet, so the internet changes the playing field. The internet creates a scenario where, like we said, there's a lot of good you can do and there's a lot of unpleasant good you could also do, but clearly the risks are much greater. It's clearly easy to destroy someone with a misplaced word. It's going to travel around the world much more quickly, and it's going to have a much longer lasting impact, and it's going to be much harder to know what's true and what's not true. There are all kinds of unique challenges that the internet poses, and if we're going to be users of the internet, so then we have to be able to try to be sensitive to what are the new challenges that come from this context. So how can we calibrate? How can we make sure that we have a proper perspective so that we're utilizing everything for good and not for bad, and that we're prepared for the new challenges that come with this shift in technology that causes such a shift in how we relate to each other? So I'd like to consider that question over the next few minutes through the prism first of one specific detail that you find in the laws of Lashon Hara, which I think tells us a lot about the nature of our society as a whole. There is a surprising statement the Talmud has in the context of Lashon Hara, which is a topic of a lot of discussion. It's very hard to understand exactly what's going on. I assume there's no one here named Yehoshaphat, right? Is that a good, safe guess? All right. So let's say if I were to tell you that, say if I were to take one person alone, if I were to go to Mr. Einhorn alone privately and say, Yehoshaphat is a jerk, I just want you to know that. Right? So that would presumably be Lashon Hara, correct? So let's say I were to say that same thing in front of this whole room, in front of everyone here. So is that better or is that worse? Presumably it's worse, right? Presumably if I say it in front of one person and I communicate this information to one person, that's bad. I would assume that exponentially, really, not just straight, but exponentially, if I tell more people, it's going to spread much further, and that should be much worse. So if that's your assumption, you're in good company. Chafetz Chaim writes the same thing. Chafetz Chaim writes explicitly in his work that it's bad to speak like this to one person. It's much worse to speak like that to many people, as you would think. But we have an issue with the Talmud. Chafetz Chaim is on our side on this point, but the Talmud has a statement which is hard to understand. Because the Talmud has a statement which I will translate very vaguely because it's a big issue how to translate it. There's many different perspectives. But the Talmud has a statement, the Aramaic phrase is ape tlasa. Ape tlasa is Aramaic for in front of three people, which is code word for public knowledge. It's code word for the public because the assumption is that if three people know something, the whole world knows already. Because as the Talmud said, your friend has a friend, and your friend's friend has a friend, and your friend's friend has a cousin who has a neighbor who has a haircutter, who has a dog walker, who has a babysitter who knows somebody else. Eventually, if three people know, the whole world knows. So three is considered public knowledge. So the Talmud has a statement which, I'll translate vaguely, anything that's in front of three, anything that's ape tlasa, no lashon hara. That's an awkwardly constructed statement, but the point is it's not clear what it means. Basically, that's what it says. Les buhum mishum lishnabisha, no lashon hara if it's in front of three. So what does that statement mean? Does it mean that it becomes somehow okay because there's more people there, because it's public knowledge, that should make it all right? That's very hard to believe. So there are many different views among the earlier commentaries, among the Rishonim, there are at least four different views, just to quickly get a sense of the range of what we're talking about. So the most commonly understood take on this is the view of Maimonides, the Rambam. That the Rambam understands that it doesn't mean that you're allowed to say something because there are more people listening, that all of a sudden it becomes permitted. Like we said, that's very hard to believe. How could that be? So it doesn't mean that. What it means, if that something was already said by someone else in front of three people, it was said in public, and you are the listener, so then, if you're the listener, so then you can assume that already the whole world knows because it was said in front of three people. So you would be allowed to repeat it. You wouldn't be subject to a prohibition of Lashon Hara if you repeated it. But that's, again, that's the most common interpretation, the most popular interpretation of this passage. But there's all kinds of difficulties. Because first of all, so it's saying that the first person who spoke did so sinfully. The first person did something very wrong and committed a major offense against somebody. So the listener is coming in a strange position that because of that, now he's allowed to do it. And as many of the commentaries ask, well, even if it's public, but it's not public right away, so you're going to accelerate the spreading of the information? Isn't that like saying that if somebody leaves his door unlocked, so you're allowed to rob his stuff because somebody else will do it eventually, so you might as well rob it first so it's not going to cause any more problems? So that's probably not true, right? So why would this be any different? And on top of that, isn't it still pretty sleazy? Isn't it still pretty gossipy and negative to talk about this, even if it's going to get out without you? Are we saying that it's problem-free for you to do this because it's going to get out there? So there are many questions on Maimonides' position. And in fact, Maimonides himself says later on that this is only true if you're not actively trying to spread it and you're not trying to disparage the person. It just kind of comes up in conversation. He has all kinds of conditions which are actually not in the Talmud, so there's a whole discussion where he gets them from. It's a complex issue how exactly to understand what this passage is saying, and even the most commonly accepted interpretation, that of the Rambam, is fraught with problems. And there's a similar position, Rashi, in his commentary to the Talmud elsewhere. So Rashi has a similar but slightly different interpretation, which has fewer problems, but makes the whole idea very narrow. That Rashi says it's talking about something where the assumption is that the listener, who, again, he's saying like Maimonides, it's about the listener, but that the listener can assume that the speaker knows that it's going to be public because it's in front of three. So therefore, the listener can consider himself having permission to repeat it. So that's okay, but that only works for a very narrow category. It means that it's something the speaker himself has the right to give permission to him to speak about. If it's normal Lashon Hara, so he wasn't justified in the first place. So it must be we're talking not about Lashon Hara, really. We're talking about some confidentiality issue, that the speaker is saying something which he has the right to say, but maybe you should worry that you're violating his confidence if you repeat it to anyone else. So then, if you know he said it in front of three people, so then presumably he doesn't care that it's going to get out there, so then you're entitled, you can consider it like you have his permission to repeat it. But if that's true, it's very narrow. It's not about Lashon Hara at all. It's only about things that the speaker himself has the right to reveal and the right to give other people the permission to reveal. So that was the second interpretation. The third interpretation was Rabbeinu Yonah, one of the great and medieval ethicists. Rabbeinu Yonah said that it is talking about the speaker. Right, that the first two interpretations says it's really about the listener. But Rabbeinu Yonah says it is talking about the speaker. The speaker has the right to say something specifically because it's in public. The same kind of thing he couldn't say in private, he can say in public. Why should that be? So counterintuitive. So, says Rabbeinu Yonah, it's because we assume that it's purposeful. We assume that it's something which needs to be said in order to protect society from some kind of threat. And if that's the case, so then, if you're going to say it, you have to say it in a way that's going to accomplish something. So if you're going to just whisper in the corner and just gossip about it, that's not going to do anything. So you'll be speaking badly about something that's an important issue, but you're not doing it in a way that's going to have any impact. So if you feel it's necessary to say it. Then don't whisper it in the corner. Say it in a way that it's going to actually have an impact and it's going to make a difference. Otherwise, there's no justification for saying it in the first place. That was Rabbeinu Yonah's position. That's an interesting view as well, which also has an impact for how we engage on the internet. There's a lot of gossip that goes on in the internet, which is not at all purposeful because it can't be communicated in any kind of a productive way. It's just a kind of whispering in the corner, but without any identity. But we'll come back to that point. But what I'm particularly interested in for the contemporary internet culture is the fourth view. The fourth view is the opinion of Tosfos. Tosfos, on the side of the page of the Talmud, Tosfos has a view which says a lot about society then, and maybe a lot about society now. And Tosfos, in addressing this statement of why it should be better if you're saying something in public, Tosfos makes reference to another equally baffling statement that appears in another passage in the Talmud. And he interprets the two consistently with each other. He interprets the two together. That there is a passage, to go back to our friend Yehoshaphat, so we already established that if I say Yehoshaphat is a jerk, if I say it to you privately, that's already Lashon Hara, right? Let's say I say it to you and Yehoshaphat is sitting right here at the same time. So is that better or is that worse? Probably also think worse, right? So not only am I speaking Lashon Hara to the other people who are listening, but I'm also embarrassing him, right? So now he's here to see it, so he's going to be humiliated in front of all those people, which is itself a very serious Torah prohibition. So one would assume that I have greatly worsened the situation by doing it in his presence. And again, if that's the conclusion you come to, again, you're in good company. The Chafetz Chaim says the same thing, that to speak about somebody behind their back is bad, to speak about them in front of them is worse, because then they're also embarrassed. However, there is the statement in the Talmud, very similar to the Ape Tlasa one, a little bit different, Ape Mara. Ape Mara means in front of the subject. If you say something in front of the subject, so says the Talmud again, that kind of speech doesn't have a prohibition of Lashon Hara attached to it. So two baffling statements together. Here we think both of these factors would make it worse, that it's being said in public and it's being said in front of the person, and somehow those two factors make it okay. What's going on? So says Tosfos, he says there's a common element between the two. And in both cases, again, we're not really talking about real Lashon Hara here. We're talking about a very narrow category, but it's very instructive for other things. That in this category, says Tosfos, it's not that you're actually saying something bad about somebody. You're really saying something good. But it's something which is phrased in a way that could be interpreted either positively or negatively. It's a little bit ambiguous. So normally, maybe you have to worry that you shouldn't say it, because even though you mean it positively, but if there's a chance that your listeners are going to interpret it negatively, so then you shouldn't say it. So says Tosfos, that's right. That's normally the rule for such category of statements. But if it's in public, or if the person is there, then you have a right to assume the listeners will understand that you only meant it positively. So let's say, for example, I'm going to say, Yehoshaphat, you can always count on him. Right? So it might mean you can always rely on him to help, or it might mean you can always count on him to do the wrong thing. You can always count on him to mess up. So if I were to say to you in private, Yehoshaphat, you can always count on him, you're not going to know what I mean. You're not going to know whether I mean it positively or negatively. But if I get up at the shul dinner and Yehoshaphat is sitting there, and I say, Yehoshaphat, you can always count on him, so then we can assume, I have the right to assume that the listeners will all understand that I meant it positively. So says Tosfos, that's all the Talmud is saying. It's a very narrow category, that in this in-between kind of area with an ambiguous statement, if you have these elements, so then you have a right to assume it will be taken in the sense that it is. Now think about what that reflects about our contemporary society. So Tosfos is essentially interpreting the Talmud as saying that even though, yes, people have a tendency to gossip about others, and people have a tendency to be negative and to say things that are not nice, but if it's in public, and it's going to get back to the guy, or the guy is there himself, he's going to hear it, then you wouldn't do such a thing. Then you wouldn't speak in such a negative way, and we can assume that that's got to be something else. We can assume that it was positive. Now we have to ask ourselves, in 2014, in the internet culture, is that assumption still true? So here, we have things that are said in the internet. The internet is not Ape Tlus, it's Ape 7 billion, right? A World Wide Web means it's being said in front of the entire world, and presumably including the person who is being spoken about. Is it still true that your average decent Jew is not going to say things that are going to be taken negatively in that context? Seems like it isn't. It seems like there's been a major shift in terms of how we relate to each other. And if that's the case, so then it's incumbent upon us to be aware of that and to correct for that and to try to realize that if we're going to use the internet effectively, we have to also be aware of how our culture has been affected by it. And it's not just about Lashon Hara, it's true about other related prohibitions. We have a prohibition called Onas Devarim. We're not allowed to say things that cause emotional pain to others. And through the context of the internet, you'll find there are statements which people would never say to someone's face. And yet, they say them on comments, on blogs, knowing that the people are going to read them. And it seems like there's just a whole different way of connecting with people. And areas such as that require a much greater sensitivity to what's going on. And that's one of the ways in which, if we're going to use this in a way that's appropriate, have to be aware, at least, and sensitive to how things have changed. And you find many of the laws of Lashon Hara that are relevant to this new environment and have a new context to them. So, for example, there is a concept called Avak Lashon Hara, which is maybe translated best as second-degree Lashon Hara. It's within the realm of Lashon Hara, but it's a little bit of a remove, but it's prohibited as well. It's what I was alluding to before in terms of you try to avoid saying bad things by saying good things, but it's not always so safe because the Talmud says that to say good things about people could also be Lashon Hara. Why is that? So it sounds like the issue is, different interpretations in the commentaries why it is, but it could be the reason it's problematic is because sometimes if you say something good, so your listeners may feel they have to object, may feel like they have a different opinion. And by saying this good thing, so you're going to prompt somebody else to say something bad. So you're going to cause this person to be disparaged, even though you were trying to be nice. But the result is you're going to bring about bad statements about this person. So that's a comment that the Talmud has. And there are a couple of very major implications for the internet culture. Because first of all, it shows us that you're not liable only for what you say, but you're liable also for what you provoke. What you cause other people to say is also your responsibility. So, for example, if you have a blog and you have comments on the blog, so you could say, all right, I'll be careful what I write on the blog and I'll make sure only to write things that are nice. But if you're hosting an unedited comment section, so then people can say whatever they want, if that's going to be problematic, that'll also be your liability. That's what seems to emerge directly from the statement in the Talmud, that you're liable not only for what you say, but also for what you provoke, and presumably certainly what you host and disseminate. One would think, well, the more so, that's a part of your liability.
Is there mechila here? Let's say you do an interpretive dance performance, and you know that people are going to review it online.
Right.
You know that when you get up there to dance, the culture is that it will be reviewed online. So therefore, there is a mechila that you are saying that since I'm putting out my album or I'm doing my dance or whatever it is, I'm allowing other people to comment without regard, because I know it's part of the system. Is there a mafila enabled over here?
So that's a great question. I want to address that in 1 second. Is there a reason you picked interpretive dance specifically?
I have something in mind.
So let's address that in 1 second. I just want to say one more point about Avak Lashon Hara, because it's awesome, and I'll come right back to that question. It's a very important question. So I'll come back to it in 1 second.
Yeah, I just want to go on one other level, right? Mm-hmm. So now my friend here is Chaim is now going to review this very negatively, very harshly. That could obviously be considered Lashon Hara, and I hit like.
Right.
What did I just do?
You liked something.
Could I? Yeah. Is that okay?
You're trying to say that you like it instead of like it and you do like it.
So if I'm liking his Lashon Hara, am I over anything?
Very possibly. So that's another great question. That's another great question. So that's actually a separate question, because if you want to ask that question more simply so as not to involve other factors, let's not build it on Rabbi Einhorn's question. Let's assume the first speaker was speaking Lashon Hara. And then the question is, what is the impact of your liking it? Because that's a little simpler without involving the two parts of the question. So we have two questions on deck. So let's just mention one other point about Avak. We'll come to these two questions. And I'm not sure how much time we have, about 15 minutes more. Is that right?
All
right.
Second degree,
okay. So this point about Avak Lashon Hara is also very relevant specifically to the internet culture, because one, this point that you're liable for what you provoke, but also the idea that if you speak positively, maybe you'll provoke somebody to say something negatively. So that's a problem which the Talmud already identified. But one could say that sometimes it's safe. You know, sometimes you know your audience, you have a small group of people, you know that everybody's friendly, and you know that you can safely say something positive about somebody else. You're not going to start any kind of a rebuttal session. You know that it's safe. But in the contemporary internet culture, that's pretty much impossible. There's almost nothing that's innocent enough that there isn't somebody somewhere in the world who's so passionately who's so passionately against this person, that if you write the most sunshine kind of thing about somebody who has, you think, no enemies in the world, you'll find somewhere somebody in the world who's been got a Google alert for this guy and who's looking out for any positive mention and who's going to say that, oh, you think he's great, I'll tell you he's terrible. So we have a different kind of culture today, where once upon a time maybe you could have thought, yeah, I know my audience, it's safe, I could say something, it's not going to provoke any negativity. And nowadays it's much harder. So the question is, what do you do about that? Does that mean you can't say anything positive on the internet? Not necessarily. You have to also be aware of the question of comments and the like, and it happens to be Rabbeinu Yonah addresses this long before the internet. Rabbeinu Yonah in Shari Tshuva addresses something very similar. He writes this issue that when you have a larger crowd of people, it becomes a bigger issue, this Avak Lashon Hara issue, the likelihood that somebody is going to object. So he writes already 1,000 years ago that this is something to worry about when that's an issue. But he also writes that a way to correct that a little bit is that if you create a context where the one person who's going to get up and say, oh, I think he's a jerk, he's going to feel embarrassed to do that, because it's so clear from the tone that you're setting that that's not going to be an acceptable comment, then that might be a corrective to that situation. So theoretically, maybe that's the kind of attitude that one has to bring into the internet context. And in the context of these comments, so these comments are an issue even before you get on to anything about anonymity. There is a whole syndrome which the psychologists have identified called the online disinhibition effect. The fact that when people are online in their pajamas in front of a computer screen and they don't see who they're talking about, who they're talking to, so they let themselves say things that they never would say in real life, they would never would say in person. And that's already a very serious issue, and that's before you even come on to anonymity. Then, if people are actually anonymous also on top of that, so then you can only imagine, Plato already wrote about what would happen if you had a magical ring that could make you invisible and you could get away with things without anyone knowing, what would happen to our moral behavior. So you can only imagine, if we assume that there is moral regulations in terms of speech, and now you have an environment in which people can speak and no one's ever going to know who they are, no one's ever going to connect it to them, so we don't have to imagine what that could bring about, because we know what that could bring about. We've seen that, and that's, again, a very serious issue. So those are some points that are particular to the internet. So in terms of the two questions we have, I think I'll take your question first, because it's more internet-specific, and then we'll come back to Rabbi Einhorn's question, Mechila Sarab. So the question about liking, so it's a very important issue. The question was, let's say somebody have on Facebook, you have a like button, so somebody says something, and let's assume for simplicity's sake, what the person said was overt Lashon Hara, so what is your responsibility if you like it, if you share it, if you send around the link? So that's a very serious issue, because we have a prohibition in the Torah, which is a correlate prohibition to Lashon Hara called Kabbalah's Lashon Hara. It means that one is not allowed to receive Lashon Hara, and it's been the topic of a big debate what that means to receive Lashon Hara. It doesn't mean exactly to listen to Lashon Hara. It means something more. That's what everyone agrees, that it means something more. Chafetz Chaim felt that there's a different prohibition to listen to Lashon Hara. There's another prohibition, a more serious prohibition, to accept Lashon Hara. So we don't know exactly what the terms are. The Chafetz Chaim had one interpretation, the Chazon Ish had another interpretation. It was a little bit of a debate whether it has to do with believing something, or whether it has to do with endorsing something, or whether it has to do with acting off the premise that something is true when it might not be true. It's a big debate, which is a little bit outside our time parameters for today. But it does seem like this is a highly relevant concept, because one of the points the Chafetz Chaim makes when he talks about receiving Lashon Hara, he says certainly it's important that if somebody's telling you something negative and it's prohibited in Lashon Hara, you have to not do anything which endorses the message. If again, he said, even if you're nodding, just so you could look like one of the cool guys, so when they're talking about everyone else, you'll sit there and nodding. Even the nodding, that's also an act of Lashon Hara, because you're strengthening this comment. So it seems very clear that the act that you have, which the internet facilitates, of sharing something, of sending around the link, of liking it, all of these are acts of endorsing the statement. It seems like this would very solidly fit into existing categories of the prohibition of Kabbalah Slash and Hara, and even more than Kabbalah Slash and Hara. And that's a very serious issue, which most people don't take so seriously. And that's a very serious question, especially also because applying the idea of public knowledge to the internet is a little complicated nowadays, because on the one hand, everything's out there, and anyone can search for anything and find it. On the other hand, there's so much out there that people don't necessarily know. So for you to send around a link or to send around some kind of a post, so you think, okay, everyone knows already, it's out there, but it's not so clear that everyone knows, not so clear that you're not doing a lot more damage by sending it around that way. So that's a very complicated question. Sometimes it's legitimate, sometimes it's not. Again, it's going to depend on the same issue. Presumably, doing something like liking this item is an extension of the original writing, of the original speech. So if it's justified in the first place, it could be justified to endorse it, or still might not be justified, because maybe it accomplished what it needed to accomplish by itself. So if the original statement is not justified, so then to send it around would seem to all the more so be a extension of that action, unless you're doing it, which sometimes is the case, doing it in order to bring about a rebuttal of the statement, in order to show why it's incorrect. But that's also a little bit tricky, and that also sometimes can do more harm than good. So it goes back to being essentially a big judgment call, but it draws on these very serious issues, which now with a click of a button, you don't even have to click a button, it's so easy to violate this, it's a very serious issue. So I think we're almost going to run out of time soon, but Rabbi Einhorn's question about the reviews and mechila. So it's tricky. There is a lot to be said about reviews. Reviews, in general, the assumption is that reviews are permitted, because that reviews fall under the category of purposeful speech. But that being said, there's a lot to be aware of. That first of all, the idea that it's purposeful, so it comes from two ideas. That first of all, yes, there is a little bit of an assumption that when somebody does something in the public realm, they are submitting it for public analysis. That on one level is true. It's not the whole story. We'll come back to that in a second. But on some level, that may be true. Second of all, the assumption is if it's something people are going to spend money on or people are going to spend their time on, so then it is for a purpose that they should know how to spend their money and how to spend their time. So to give them a sense of whether this is worthwhile or not, so that theoretically is purposeful. So I think from an opening perspective, there is justification for reviews, although not all poskim agreed. There are great Gedolia poskim who thought that reviews were not justified, but certainly the custom of the world is to assume that reviews are at least theoretically justified, coming from those two premises that that which is done in public is meant to be analyzed in public, and that's the nature of the industries that we're talking about, and that it serves the consuming public to know how to spend their time and money, and it's purposeful. That being said, there are all kinds of pitfalls, because still, even within the parameters of Toelis, as we've said before, there are all kinds of rules for Toelis, so one can still be more negative than is justified. One may have a personal axe to grind, which may make its way into the comments. One may make comments which are not really grounded in the actual reality of the story. And one may overinflate the importance of his own opinion. There's all kinds of ways to do this which are not going to be appropriate. And in terms of mechila, so we have to figure out whether or not mechila works. Mechila doesn't really work in terms of personal humiliation. That's how the halachic authorities write, that the idea that you could say it's okay for somebody to humiliate you in public, it doesn't really work. It means maybe that under some circumstances it's legitimate. We'll have to find another opportunity to come back and explain our shared history in the Purim Spiels. I think that's, or maybe I'll spend a minute on it just because it's been brought up. But that's a big question. So as Rabbi Arnheim mentioned, we had the privilege of being involved many years together in the production of Purim Spiels at YU. So that's a big topic of halachic analysis as well, that why is it that that's okay? Why is it that it's all right to have these performances where people are imitated, where we perform skits based on people, and hopefully people are laughing, which makes you think you might be joking about them. So why is that okay? So that's a whole topic which needs to be understood a little bit. It's not okay because it's a joke. The Rambam and the Chafetz Chaim both write that Lashon Hara Derech Schok, if you're doing it as a joke, doesn't make it okay. That's not a justification for Lashon Hara. So that's not the answer. So then what's the second answer? What's the second possible answer? So you might say, okay, mechila, that we assume that the people who are involved, that so we portray the Rebbeim and Yeshiva, so you say, okay, the Rebbeim and Yeshiva, they're okay with it. So that's what makes it okay. Not totally. Yeah, that's a part of it, that I think that if Rebbe is makvid, then he certainly should not be portrayed, that if somebody is overtly not mochel, or implicitly not mochel, then it should not be a part of this production. That's true. But it's not enough of the story, because if you were really humiliating the person, so then it's not clear that this idea of the person being okay with it, it doesn't take. Even though, yes, theoretically, a person should have the right to be okay with whatever he's okay with, but he's never bound to that. That if he says he's okay, he can portray me, and then he ends up feeling humiliated, you're not going to be off the hook because of that. That's not essentially the waiving of your rights. The halacha doesn't see it as irrevocable. It doesn't see it as really lasting. You can only waive your monetary rights. If somebody owes you money and you say, I'm ochel, you can keep the money, it's okay. But to say that you can humiliate me, it doesn't take. And if it ends up still being embarrassing, it's going to be an issue.
What's the policy now in YU?
Well, they don't have Rabbi Einhorn anymore, which is a big change in policy.
No, but do they still mention the Rebbes?
They absolutely do. Right, and this, by the way, so I should also parenthetically mention, I'll say now what I think is a third approach, which I think is what makes it okay, but I should first acknowledge that this was a major debate in Poskim, that much of the printed tshuva literature about this topic were very against spiels. There was a lot of printed tshuvas that are very opposed to Purim spiels and to Purim Torah of all kinds. But there is another trend also, that the Volozhiner Yeshiva, there was a very established trend of Purim spiels and intels and in other places, and as Rav Schechter points out, YU was founded by people who came over from Volozhin, so we have all the exact same customs in every little detail. So one of the customs we have from Volozhin is the Purim Spiel. It was recorded. It's recorded in the history books that in the days when the Netziv was the Rashiv in Volozhin, so the best student was a young man named Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. And he apparently did a spot-on imitation of the Netziv. He did a perfect imitation of the Netziv. And it sounds very much like the YU Purim Spiels. So then it says many decades later, so in Merkaz Harav, the yeshiva that Rav Cook founded, so the top student was the Netziv's great-grandson, and he did a spot-on imitation of Rav Cook. He had, so Rav Cook said, okay, it's been paid back. You know, it's been, so there was a tradition in some great yeshivas in Volozhin and elsewhere to have such a spiel, and there are many poskim who are understandably very concerned about where it could go, so we can understand where that tradition comes from, but the tradition that we have continued at yeshiva, that it is a part of our culture. So I think, again, it's not because it's a joke, and it's not because of Mechila totally, although that's a part of it. I think the real answer is like Tosfos, we said before, that there's a certain context when it's clear that something is not meant with any kind of negativity, and that if you're able to create an atmosphere, and the fact that it's Purim also helps to create the atmosphere once it's the established practice, that this is not coming out of any kind of negativity, but it's coming out of love. And I think I can vouch for the idea that, for the most part, they've pretty much got it on target, that the Rebbeim and the others who are portrayed, who are generally present in the room and laughing, do feel that this is an expression of love, not an expression of negativity, and I think that's really the basis of the heter for it. Again, the fact that they're there also indicates, hopefully, that they're okay with it, but again, I think mechila is not the whole story. I think you need a little bit more than that, and that's really that the culture is one where this is taken as a loving expression rather than any kind of negativity. And that's what makes it okay. But it's clearly a thin line. It's very important to always do these things under rabbinic supervision. So I think we're almost out of time. So we'll just quickly review what we spoke about. But there's so much more to say. The point is, this is an ongoing endeavor. It's an ongoing interaction between the Jewish people and the laws of Lashon Hara. And it should be, because this really goes to the essence of how we relate to each other. It goes to the core of what it means to be a social being, and a social being that is informed by the values of the Torah. And our hope is that even as the landscape has shifted so dramatically in terms of how that interaction takes place, we're able to take this new element of technology and make sure that we can maximize all the benefits and avoid at the same time some of the very serious pitfalls. So just to quickly review, we spoke about the fact that the internet is good, has a lot of good things, has a lot of bad things also. The good things involve the nice things like Torah and Chesed and community and the like, but also involve the not so nice things like necessary Lashon Hara, like saying things that are negative but are important to warn society. But that's an area where you have a complex discussion, how to know what's right and what's not right. So we mentioned that there are some who feel the Chafetz Chaim is seven conditions, some who feel it's really one condition, and the Afik Hayam said in yesterday's Parsha that there are three conditions that emerge from the careful reading of the Parsha, that it has to be, there's no other way to accomplish the goal, and it has to be completely accurate, and it has to be with no ulterior motives. That just reflects the fact that this is a delicate area in which we're trying to figure out how exactly to judge what to do, and the internet changes things in a way that we have new decisions to make to know how exactly, not just in the fact that everything is so much more public and so much more permanent, but in many other ways as well. So we discussed the fact that Talmud says that there is some kind of license for Lashon Hara when it's public, when it's in front of three, which is hard to understand why that should make it better. So we saw four views in the Rishonim, that the Rambam says that it's okay to speak about it because it's already out there. All kinds of issues we had to figure out about that view. Rashi says it's okay because the speaker knows it's going to be public, so he's okay with it. But that only works for things the speaker is allowed to allow for other people. It's also tricky. We saw that Rabbeinu Yonah says it refers to the speaker because the speaker is saying something purposeful, so he should say it in a way that's going to have an impact, a way that's public. And Tosfos on the side of the page, who said that this is comparable to another statement in the Talmud, that you can say something in front of the subject. Both of those are saying that if you're saying something ambiguous, which could be interpreted positively or negatively, it's okay if it's in a crowd or the person is there, because then we all assume that's being said positively. So that assumption that once upon a time, if you said something in public or in front of the subject, it was positive, clearly in the internet culture that's changed very dramatically. Things are said in the World Wide Web, including the subject, and they're clearly not working off this assumption. So that shift in our mentality is something that we have to be cognizant and aware of. And we spoke about Avak Lashon Hara also. If you say something good, the Talmud says you have to worry that's going to provoke a negative rebuttal. So that becomes very relevant also, because it tells us, first of all, about comment sections, that you're responsible for what you provoke, not just what you write, but also the reality that more likely someone somewhere in the World Wide Web is going to have a negative response makes it much harder to correct for this. And we mentioned Rabbeinu Yonah's correction, where he says even in a larger crowd you have a bigger problem, but maybe you can also create a context where somebody who's going to object is going to feel unwelcome in doing so, and maybe that's going to be the corrective, and that's a part of what we have to be concerned about as well. And we talked about a little bit about anonymity and about the online disinhibition effect, which comes even without anonymity, that already causes people to say whatever they want. We talked about how that has impact for Anos Devarim, for saying hurtful things. Then we had a question about liking and sharing links, and how that very likely involves a prohibition of Kabbalah Lashon Hara, maybe even more, maybe even cross the line into actual speaking of Lashon Hara. So it's all going to depend. If the initial comment is unjustified, then for sure it's unjustified to like it or to share it. If it's justified, then you have to figure out, does it accomplish what it needs to hear, or does it need to be spread out? And then the question of reviews, which I actually didn't finish, just to finish that point. So reviews, coming from the beginning of the question, reviews are justified based on the fact that the content is meant for public review and is meant for the public's benefits. They shouldn't waste their time or money. They should know how to spend their time and money. But that being said, there are all kinds of things you could still do wrong within that. And I think that's also an important question. We talk about newspapers, we talk about reviews, talk about blogs, talk about the internet. It's not a yes or no question. It's not that, okay, well, newspaper's okay, so whatever's in the newspaper is fine. Or reviews are okay, whatever's in the review is okay. Yes, there could be appropriate reviews and newspapers and internet pages and blogs and the like, but still all the many, many questions that come up within that all still apply and all still have to be thought about. And hopefully that ongoing interaction with the text and with the reality of human interaction should be a source of benefit to us and not of anything else.
Oh, yes.
Do you have time for a question?
Oh, yes.
Really?
In the joking a lot, in public or not in public, in front of children or not in front of children, in the arena of joking, many times we joke about others. We mention names and we make jokes, sometimes even after sermons.
What?
And the children, not the rabbis, but
no,
the rabbis, or it could be a speaker, it could be a guest, it could be somebody who's funny, whatever. I think that it's very dangerous for children, raising children, the whole notion about joking,
mm-hmm.
because they don't know where the line is.
Yeah.
Also, I think as parents, joking with the children is very dangerous because then they become all of a sudden chutzpah.
You're 100% right. It's very... You're 100% right, and I'll just mention one point about that, is that I endorse very much what you're saying, have to be very sensitive to that. It is noteworthy that there was a major debate in the literature about 30 years ago, 40 years ago, that Rav Moshe Feinstein is the greatest halachic authority of the previous generation. Rav Moshe Feinstein had a very controversial ruling, which many argued on. He said that a teacher should not try to get a student to tell on another student. He said, because you're teaching this student to engage in Lashon Hara. So many others objected, and they said that, but we have a principle that if it's purposeful, it's okay. So why should you teach the child that if he's going to say something that's for a purpose, to help the student and to help everyone else, it's okay? And Rav Moshe thought that no, that the young students, they're not going to be able to understand the difference. All they're going to know is that you're being trained to speak about others. And the older people, they can appreciate the nuances, they can appreciate their circumstances where okay and where it's not okay. But for a child to be taught, he was saying especially the teacher is going to solicit these comments, going to tell the students. The child comes forward on his own, you can explain to him, okay, you know, it is what it is. But for a teacher to say, tell me what you can tell me about the other students. So Rav Moshe thought that was a highly problematic way of raising children. Others disagreed because they were very concerned about what might go untaken care of if that was the attitude. And Rav Moshe held his ground. He had another, another round. They objected. He wrote back. He still thinks it's true. It was a whole debate, but it goes very much to what you're saying, that especially when dealing with children, you have to be aware that there is a possibility that some of the nuances get lost, and that for sure is a very serious consideration. I think now we're out of time. So I thank you very much.